First item on the agenda is the quarterly police update. Our chief is here to address the council. Welcome.
Hi, thanks, Mayor and members of the council. We'll get started with Lieutenant Pete Underton. If you don't know, Pete was in our patrol division recently, was transferred into our investigative division. So he's the investigative lieutenant right now. He's also, in case you didn't know, I'm hoping I told you at some point, he's the assistant commander for the West Metro SWAT team. So he's going to take it away for you regarding no-knock unannounced entry warrants.
Thanks for having me tonight. Have a brief presentation for you from the little bit of a legal perspective and from the SWAT team tactical perspective on unannounced no-knock warrants, which I know everybody's seen in the news in the last year, and we've had some legislative changes in the last probably 24 months that are pertinent. So anytime during the presentation, if anybody has a question on any of the slides or anything I have to say, if you just stop me and let me know, we'll try and address those. And then afterwards, we'll have a little Q&A session that hopefully I can clear anything up for you guys. Okay. So West Metro SWAT, I'm sure the chief's talked about this before. We have in between 16 to 24 members at any given time from New Hope, Robbinsdale, and Crystal. So our training is kind of guided by the national tactical standards from the National Tactical Officers Association. We do monthly trainings, and we do a couple of week-long trainings every year. Training is highly important in a field such as ours that has high liability. So our operators have different specialized roles and trainings, and our main job that we provide service for is providing high-risk warrant entry, hostage rescue, and barricaded suspect solutions.
Where does that training take place?
So a training could take place at a variety of different locations. We have probably 35 different training types that we do, from vehicle operations to less lethal options, firearms accuracy practice. So we'll be at ranges. We'll use houses that the city has bought and is going to demolish and redevelop before the fire department burns them down. We have training facility up at Hennepin Technical College that has a lot of good scenario rooms. So we've been kind of branching out and using as many of the different options as we have to give the team members a variety.
Good. Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about just kind of lay the groundwork for unannounced entries. I want to talk a little bit knock and announce. So this idea came from common law prior to the Constitution that if an officer was going to come to your residence and search, he could break and enter, but first had to give his notice of office and authority and purpose. And then be refused admittance before he could then break into your house. So that's where this law kind of comes from. Courts have since ruled that the practice of announcing authority and purpose is a constitutional requirement known as knock and announce. So this is memorialized in federal law 18 USC 3109. Officer may break open any door or window of the house or any part of the house or anything therein to execute a search warrant if after notice of authority and purpose, he is refused admittance. So that's your knock and announce doctrine and memorialized in federal law. Here are some case laws. As we know, laws are created. Sometimes they are vague and judges have to decide what they actually mean. So these are some case laws from U.S. districts of appellate regarding knocking and announcing and what does that actually mean. So although the principle is commonly referred to as knock and announce, the court's holding in Wilson requires only an announcement. So this case with Wilson, officers went to the house. Wilson was at the door. They told him that they had a search warrant for his residence. He slammed the door. They kicked it in without actually physically knocking. So this tells us that we don't actually have to knock. We just have to announce our presence, and the person who is subject to the search would reasonably believe and understand what our intention is. Next case law, U.S. versus Spikes from 1998. The focus of the knock and announce rule is properly not on what magic words the police use, but whether the police rang the doorbell, but rather on how these words or other actions of the police would be perceived by the occupant. So this is in what manner do we knock, what manner do we announce? This kind of addresses that, and they take the view of what would the resident inside believe was happening when the police showed up. So in this case, the police showed up, turned on the lights and siren outside of the house, got on the loudhailer and said, "This is the police, we have a search warrant." Officers who were deployed on the rear of the residence heard the announcements. Neighbors down the street came out of their house to watch what was going on. The person in this case said they didn't knock and announce. The court said, yes, they did effectively. So The next case, U.S. versus Combs, Ninth Circuit. We must examine what, if any, notice the police gave before entry and the likelihood that the notice alerted those inside the home to the officer's presence and purpose. This is along the same line as the last decision. Make a reasonable effort to announce your presence. You don't necessarily need to knock on the door. Any questions on that? Okay. So we get to a no-knock warrant. No-knock has been the phrase that's kind of been colloquially used through all these last couple of years when we've had some high-profile incidents. What it really is referring to is an unannounced search warrant. So it's a search warrant that you're serving on a residence where you're entering in and you're taking the person by surprise. They would have no idea that the police are coming in until they face you or you make some sort of announcement when you're in. We've seen these on TV shows and a lot of the shows from before that profiled SWAT teams where they're sneaking up in the night. They're smacking open a door, they rush in, and that's when they announce. So this is an unannounced search warrant referred to as a no-knock. To get a no-knock warrant, there has to be a legal judicial exception to the constitutional knock and announce requirement. So you can't just go and serve a warrant no-knock. You have to prove to a judge that you have grounds to do so. This is our Minnesota statute 626-14. This was amended in 21 after some high-profile incidents. They break out and define what a no-knock actually is. They specify the times for search warrants, which at ours had previously been in existence, that you can't serve a search warrant outside the hours of 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. unless the court determines that the facts stated in the affidavits that a nighttime search outside those hours is necessary, and I highlight here, to prevent the loss, destruction, or removal of the objects of the search, or to protect the searchers or the public. So when are we requesting no-knock warrants, or when have we historically requested them? It's when we believe people inside are going to destroy the evidence that we're searching for, or that they're going to offer us some sort of threat of harm or harm the public. So this statute does go in to define no-knock warrants as authoring peace officers to enter certain premises first without knocking and announcing the officer's presence. And we'll talk about where no-knock or unannounced warrants apply in other situations too, not related to going into a house. So also 626-14 outlined a couple things that we have to do now regarding no-knock warrants, because the legislature and everybody knows that sunlight is the best disinfectant. They wanted us to be clear with what we're actually doing and report that to committees with the legislature so they can analyze how often we're using these warrants and in what situations, and are people being harmed because of them. So now when we apply for these warrants, we have to, we've always had to explain to a judge why we're wanting to use a no-knock and why we can't detain the suspect through the use of a knock and announce warrant. And then also clearly define what investigative activities we've done to support the issuance of a no-knock warrant. So for example, a drug task force might be following a violent offender and they are regularly seeing him grab an AK-47 out of his car and enter into his residence with a high-powered rifle back and forth. This is right out of a case that we've investigated and that we've done a search warrant on. This is an example of something you would provide to a judge to say, hey, this is a highly dangerous situation. We're going to encounter potential gunfire if we use certain tactics. And also, we have to explain if the warrant can be executed during the daylight hours or night. New to this statute, all of these warrants have to be reviewed by a chief or a designee and be signed off by a supervisor, a chief, or a designee before they can be presented to a judge. So it's putting in a couple of layers of additional eyes on the warrant with cascading supervision to make sure that we're justifying ourselves appropriately. And then also down here, as we've seen with drug possession being decriminalized as time goes on, the legislature is responding to that. And in clause D down here, you'll see that a no-knock search warrant shall not be issued when the only crime is alleged possession of controlled substance, unless there's probable cause to believe that a controlled substance is other than for personal use. And this is to keep people for taking a SWAT team in to go recover a couple of grams of marijuana. So we're working with this statute now. Little explanation. This is a picture of a house in Crystal. This is actually a case that I dealt with when I was back in the task force. That was right across the street from a school. So this is the kind of things that our narcotics officers are encountering when they're going into these residences, when you're talking about drug traffickers. that are subject to robberies and are employing weapons to defend themselves. So the no-knock really started being used more frequently, I think, during the 1980s war on drugs, during the crack epidemic, when the violence was spiking. The tactics back then from tactical teams were speed, surprise, and intimidation. So this is what you would see on the old SWAT shows, where they had smacked the door open, they'd flood the house with a bunch of guys in scary gear with guns, they'd throw flashbangs in, and the whole idea behind this tactical premise was to overwhelm the subject in the middle of the night, who hopefully is sleeping, and get to them, surprise them, and take them into custody before they can formulate a plan to react with violence. And that went on for quite a bunch of times, but for quite a few years, but the National Tactical Officers Association has been studying these warrants, and they've found that often they lead to injuries to officers and subjects that might have been avoided otherwise. So as the years have gone on, as the laws have evolved, the tactics have also evolved. So then I spoke a little bit earlier about other types of unannounced warrants. So besides the entry into the house, where you're smacking open the door and going in without announcing, there's a bunch of different situations where you wouldn't want to announce the service of warrant. Specifically, if you're searching a cell phone in an ongoing investigation, you may not want to disclose to the suspect that you're searching their cell phone, because that would cause them to delete. Tracking. So trackers are employed a lot of times to follow subjects that are involved in criminal activity, like bank robbers. You're not necessarily going to want to announce that you're placing a tracker on their car. So sky's the limit. You can think of different situations where you wouldn't want to announce. The dilemma we're facing right now with reporting these search warrants to the legislature is, do we report those as well? Because clearly the intent of the statute is for these dynamic SWAT team type of entries, right? Not a tracker for a vehicle. Tracker for a vehicle is most often not going to result in a violent confrontation with police. So that's the dilemma that we're looking at right now, and we're getting legal advice on reporting as we speak to see how we're going to deal with that. But so this just kind of goes through the process, chain of events for an unannounced warrant request. So a detective will be investigating a case and understand that they need a search warrant. So when we're getting a search warrant for two different purposes, to recover evidence or to recover a person. So most often you've got criminal charges on a person, they're wanted in connection with a case, and they've got a warrant for their arrest. If you don't know that they're in the house for sure, but you have probable cause to leave there, you have to get a search warrant to go in the house to get it. A perfect example of this is homicide a couple of years ago in Robbinsdale. The suspect was barricaded in a residence in Brooklyn Center, and our SWAT team responded there. We actually had to get a search warrant to enter the residence to arrest him. That makes sense. When the detective understands that he or she needs to get a search warrant, they assess the threats that are involved with the case. So they're looking for the individuals who are identified in the investigation, if they have a violent history, if there's any animals, if there's barricades. A lot of these houses that people are dealing drugs out, they'll actually barricade the doors. So why that's important is a regular investigator is not going to be able to get through it with their dress shoes. They might need to get the SWAT team with a little bit bigger ram or something to break the door open. So that's part of the threat assessment. So as they make the threat assessment, they determine whether or not they're going to write a request for a warrant with a knock or a no knock. As it goes through the process, it has to go through the layers of supervision. As I explained before, if the supervisor in the drug task force and the chief decides that a no knock warrant should be issued, then it goes to a judge, and the judge is the ultimate decision maker on these cases. So if the warrant is signed and you do have a no-knock warrant, the warrant itself then goes to the tactical commander, which is kind of my job. So I have a whole threat assessment and a bunch of training on how to assess these type of situations and whether or not a SWAT team should be used. Of the warrants that I'm actually proposed to serve on the tactical team, I would say about 50% of them ever get worked on and served by a tactical team, and about, I would say, 25 to 30% of those get resolved before the team actually has to do the warrant. So as tactics have changed, as time has gone on, we have adapted our tactics as well. Understanding that from a bunch of terrible situations, that if you go in on an unannounced entry with a SWAT team and things don't go well, you're going to get officers shot and a suspect might be shot as well. So one of the first things I do when I get a request for a warrant service from a task force is I sit down with the agent and I ask him what kind of surveillance he's been conducting. What steps has he taken to try and arrest the suspect or serve the warrant without the suspect in the house? So the premise is to get the suspect out of the house, maybe when they're heading to the gas station in the morning for coffee, detain them. Now you're serving a warrant on an empty house and there's no threat inside. And you don't need a SWAT team to do that.
So Pete, I'm just going to, so you guys all heard him say when he said 50% of the warrants he sees are actually looked at, right? So 50% of those. And then of those 50%.
We might only serve, actually have the team serve 25% of those because we're able to resolve them. So oftentimes when I get it for the first review, I send it back and say, go do 3-4 days of surveillance and try and apprehend this person outside of their home. Because ultimately the goal here is to, you know, get our charges and preserve the safety of ourselves and the person we're investigating and anybody else who might be in that house. So
I have a question. So,
yes, sir.
I mean, how do you contact the judge? I mean, is this something, I mean, we know from TV, like they just show up in their office. And like
So I'll tell you when I first started how I used to contact a judge. So there is a 24/7 on-call judge number and I would contact Judge X and try and wake them up in the middle of the night. I would go to my office and I'd make a paper search warrant. I'd then go down and visit the judge at 3 a.m. in their house in their bathrobe and discuss the case with the judge, and the judge would review all the details and sign the warrant. Now that's on a situation that's rapidly evolving on the street where I need a search warrant right away. Most times what happens is there's an investigator sitting in their office during the week. They've prepped their entire case. They've drafted their application for their search warrant. Nowadays we've got e-charging, it's called. Everything is electronic, including court on Zoom. So what you do is you draft it in the system, you send it off to a judge, you give the judge a call and say, hey, I have a search warrant sitting there. The judge pops it up, they read it, they'll call you back if they have any questions.
Yeah.
They then electronically sign it, you electronically sign it, print it out, and ready to go.
Nice.
Yep. So it's gotten a lot smoother, and we're getting a warrant on the street. For an example, years ago, I wanted to search a car because I believe there was a gun inside after a shooting. I had the car. The suspect was away from the car, but now I need a warrant to get in the car. 3 hours later, I'm finally able to get in the car. Now, as a patrol officer, I can draft that warrant in my squad car, and I can be within that car in 15 minutes if we can get the judge in that amount of time. So it's pretty slick.
Technology is great, but I do have to say, when I was a rookie cop, I actually loved going to the judges' houses and seeing them in their bathrobes. So for me, it was fun.
I was like, the technology has evolved quickly, even in the last 6 years.
Right, exactly.
So I want to talk a little bit now. We've kind of got our baseline drawn for what is a knock and announce, what is a no knock, what would justify a no knock. Now I want to get into what's the practice we've been using as a SWAT team for the last 5 or 6 years. So the drug wars back in the day, with all the high-risk search warrants being done and entry, a lot of people got hurt, killed during those things. And when you take a 10,000-foot view of those and you say, what are we doing here? We're rescuing drugs from the toilet. Why are we going to sacrifice anybody's life to rescue drugs from the toilet? Because this is what we're doing, right? The state law allows us to enter without announcement to preserve evidence. But if all we're doing is going in on a drug or a weapons case, are we really going to risk the lives of all of our officers and the suspect and potentially the suspect's family and neighbors in the area to keep somebody from flushing drugs? And the answer to that clearly is no. So, and we've known that for, you know, 5 or 10 years now, and our SWAT team has been using different tactics to approach these situations. We've told our drug task force that we are not in the business of making your case for you. So if you've conducted an investigation and you haven't recovered drugs sufficient to charge the suspect, the SWAT team is not there to make your case for you. We're not going in to rescue the drugs from the toilet so you can have a good charge. You need to do a full investigation, then we'll go in and we'll apprehend the criminal and we'll see what evidence is there when we get there. Keeping that in mind, now the tactics that we use for these type of situations where we might be looking for a dangerous criminal who has guns, there's no reason to go rush inside. So we have a bunch of different ways that we can deal with those situations without putting our officers in harm's way and giving the suspect a chance to surrender. This whole planning process comes from the safety priorities. National Tactical Officers Association, I've talked about them a little bit before. they kind of collect all of the SWAT incidents from around the country, and they have experts that analyze them, and they put out best practices. So a lot of the tactics that we use, we draw from best practices. And the NTOA is directly on board with what I just said, is that we're not supposed to be rescuing drugs from the toilet. So the safety priorities used to be called the life safety priorities, but they just call it safety priorities now. This is what guides all of our tactical operations. And it's moving more into the mainstream of law enforcement every day out of the tactical realm. So these are the factors that influence our decision-making in any critical incident, any high-risk search warrant. Because we hold all life in the highest regard, as I spoke to earlier, the suspect's included in that list. So any prioritization of our efforts should be based on a person's ability to remove themselves from a dire situation. So you look at the mission profile of a SWAT team, the toughest, biggest, worst thing that we have to do is rescue hostages, right? Hostages don't have any control over the situation. They're in there at extreme risk. And so they would be the highest on the priority list. Next is innocent civilians. The next is law enforcement. And the bottom of the list, but still on the list, is the suspect. They still have a safety priority. So keeping that in mind, I've got it written on the board of my command post. So every decision I make on an incident has those life safety priorities in check in the right order. So if you think about it critically, if you have a hostage to rescue, are you willing to risk a law enforcement officer's life to rescue that hostage? Absolutely. Are you willing to risk a law enforcement officer's life to rescue an innocent civilian who might be caught in the crossfire or be in a neighborhood where somebody's actively firing rounds? Absolutely. Will you send an officer in to apprehend a dangerous suspect who's firing rounds and risk the officer's life to do that? Probably not. Life safety priorities don't authorize that. And so we have other tactics that we use. We have ballistic protected vehicles now that we can surround houses with. We have noise emitting devices. We've got flashbangs. We've got gas that we can fire in there. We've got hostage negotiators crisis negotiators that will talk to the people. So we have all these different approaches that we have, with the last possible approach would be to go in and confront a dangerous person face-to-face and force some sort of deadly force encounter. So here they are listed out. This is right from the National Tactical Officers Association, and this is doctrine within the tactical community. Hostages are first, innocent civilians, law enforcement, and then the suspect. Any questions about the tactical piece? So I can tell you that I've been on the team for, I think, 10 or 11 years now, and I was on the team when we were doing dynamic entries all the time. And I've seen the team evolve, probably starting about 7 or 6 years ago, to more of a surround and call out type of tactic, where we will have a high risk warrant where we know a person's armed, they've got a violent history, maybe they've even committed a homicide. We're not going to go smack the door and go in. Now we surround it, we start calling, and we have a list of things that we do working up to try and get the suspect to surrender. We present the suspect with choices, and then we up our intensity as we go. So that's kind of how we approach it, so that we don't have to force a face-to-face encounter. And in most of these situations, the suspects have a few different options. One is surrender. One is to shoot it out with law enforcement, and the last one is to usually take their own life in these situations. And we're always going for the surrender. So I'm sure you saw the prolonged 48-hour standoff in St. Michael a couple of weeks ago. They did the same thing up there. They started here, and they had an armed suspect who had fired shots at law enforcement, and they had to keep ramping up their tactics until ultimately resulted in shooting, but no law enforcement officers were hurt and killed, no innocent people were hurt and killed, which is the goal of the day. So now that we've kind of gone through how our team utilizes no-knock warrants, or for the most part doesn't, I have one more exception. So there's one case where we would use a no-knock or an unannounced entry, and that's in a hostage rescue situation. There's been a few different situations where these hostage things are going on for a couple of days. We had one up in New Hope where the suspect actually got drunk and passed out. And that's a perfect situation to use an unannounced entry, because we can sneak in, not wake him up, extract the child, and then leave him in there by himself, and then go to a barricaded subject where there's a kid that's not under threat anymore. So that's a case where we would probably use an unannounced. So it's something that, you know, as we talk about in the news and as we see politicians talking about it, we don't want to lose a tool. We just want to use it appropriately. Reporting requirements now. This is kind of what I discussed a little bit earlier. 626.14 amended in 2021 now requires us to report the number of no-knock search warrants requested, the number of no-knock search warrants issued, the number executed, and the number of injuries and fatalities suffered, if any, by peace officers and civilians. So I kind of talked about a little bit the questions that we have in our mind, right? So as we frame this up a little bit in our minds and we think, what's the intent? The intent is for us to capture these dynamic entries, right? But is the consequence going to be that we have to report every unannounced entry or unannounced search warrant that we're doing on a cell phone, on a tracker, and is that going to skew the numbers? So hopefully we get a little bit of clarity going forward and when we start reporting here this year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And here's just a list of different things that we might use a no-knock for that are not tactical entries.
Presentation said that you had to report it within 3 months. And so I'm assuming that they're capturing this within a certain time frame. Is it, you know, it's an annual or is it
Chief, do you know? So Sue, our records manager, is going to be doing all the reporting. And like, have they set up a database yet?
I think they have.
Yeah. Well, eventually the PCA's goal is that you'll be able to get to it real time on their website. But I believe at this point, PCA has been trying to get to report that.
Mm-hmm. Annually, okay.
Yeah, so one of the things with the search warrant too, after you serve a search warrant, it has to be filed with the court within 10 days, and they're all filed electronically now. And the ideal situation for us would be that system captures the data for us, and there doesn't have to be a reporting requirement, or that the courts are capturing the data and they're reporting it to the legislature, but I'm not 100% sure what that looks like in my position. That might be a better question for a records manager. Any questions?
No.
Hopefully I didn't go too long, but appreciate your time tonight. And hopefully I lent some clarity to anybody that had any questions about the process. And the one thing I really want to communicate is that, I think I said it probably 10 times, is that we're very concerned with life safety priority for everybody. And we want everybody to go home at the end of the day on these situations. They're some of the most intense things that we have to deal with in law enforcement. And we have a very strict set of protocols that we follow to make sure that those things reach a successful conclusion whenever they have the ability to.
After hearing Pete, you probably understand why he's in the position he's in. He's very, very good at what he does. And the reason why he's in this role, you can see through the presentation, the concerns that he has regarding everything and making sure they're following the right rule.
So I just want to kind of, for a numerical clarification, not really clarification, but like understanding, when you said 50% of all given, right, and 25% of that 50%. So if there were, you get 100 warrants, you're only looking at 50, and the actual ones that get executed is only really is like 12.5%,
yeah,
because it's 25% of that 50. I just kind of want to put that, because it's actually a very small number, which I mean, I know is totally kind of opposite of what's perceived. And even really, that's because of what's in the past. There's not really a lot of training, but not a whole lot of actual serving the war, you know, doing those anymore because of other tactics. So thank you.
And Councilmember Banks, I would say number 100 is very high.
Right.
Right. No, I was just using that as a solid number. It was easy math.
Well, yeah. The reality is that the number of warrants that make its way that you can consider half of that would be pretty aggressive.
Right. No, yeah, I'm not really good with math. Oh, okay. I'll profess that. So that was just a good hold number that I could apply. So, but we could, you know, we could move decimal points. So if you're at 10, you know, you're only looking at 5, then you're only actually doing 1.2, right?
Yeah.
Does that help? That make, there you go.
Yeah. And another point clarification to kind of add to what you're saying is, just because a no-knock warrant is issued doesn't mean that dynamic entry tactics are used, right? So they might grant us a no-knock warrant in this case, and I might decide as a tactical commander, we're going to surround the house and call the people outside because they can't flush a gun, right? We'll wait it out. We'll wait for them to come out and surrender peacefully, or we'll, if, you know, worse comes to worse and we have to fire gas in there to get them to come out, we'll do that, and then we'll go in and look for the gun after it's safe. So, you know, that'll be for explanation later on when these no-knock numbers start to come out, right, and they're reported to the legislature, is how many of these actually involve the tactical entry, dynamic entry, like you saw in the case in Minneapolis.
And you know, just...
Well, I would say, as you hear all of this information, and more importantly, as you hear the dialogue, for instance, the high-profile incident in Minneapolis, I don't have any inside scoop on any of that. What I will say is the dialogue that we had internally as a group for that is, my statement to that to our team is, it may be determined that the moment that a shooting happened, that shooting was justified by statute, but I think we missed the point if that's the only thing that we're looking at. And I'm not saying that on behalf of that particular officer. I'm saying it on behalf of law enforcement as a professional. The visual that needs to happen is what happened through all of the process that Pete described to get us to a point that we were in that confrontation. Mm-hmm. There were a number of steps along the way, in my opinion, with very limited information that need to be looked at to make sure that we really should have been in that situation. As a tactical guy, Pete's comments, we never would have done that way. We would have done it, we would have done the calling it out, we would have done it differently tactically, which is something to pay attention to. But there is a broader process. What's the approvals? What are the questions that are being asked? What information do we have? What intel do we have about where we're headed? All of that is part of the deal. So when we quickly go get rid of no-knock, to Pete's point, we're missing the point, in my opinion, about having a tool that really does potentially save lives. But we do need to be very, very careful and judicious in how it is that we go about the process.
And not to make this more cumbersome, and we can have this in a different conversation, but I'm guessing you understand the difference, right, between what Pete is talking about with no-knock or unannounced searches of warrants and an active shooter situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
The active shooter, we're going in, and we're going in to deal with the subject that is actively shooting. What SWAT does is different, right? Unless it's an active shooter situation. Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Okay. And from my perspective, if the SWAT team has gotten to an active shooter, it's gone on far too long.
It's so true.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Because it takes time to get those folks in from home, get them in their gear, and get them out there. That should be over in 3 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mayor, I just have about 5 to 8 minutes worth of stuff, and I'll breeze through it even quicker if you want me to.
Okay.
Matt's going to throw up my. Perfect. Thanks, Matt. So staffing update. We are in the midst of hiring two police officers right now who have conditional offers out there. I'm hoping to get them on board within the next month or so, which is exciting. And we are also in the process of hiring a community service officer and a records technician. We lost one of our full-time records folks to a different position. They're the folks that sit up in our front lobby who are our customer service people. So we're getting ready, hopefully to hire all of those positions very soon. Yes, sir.
Is that two sworn vacancies? Is that all we have is two vacancies, or do we?
Technically, on paper, we have two sworn vacancies. Okay. Very soon, we may have an additional two sworn vacancies just based on retirements and some other things. Yes.
Okay.
New PD update. Very exciting. You're seeing this building go up, and it's quickly progressing. And now we're getting down to the wire here on both the construction company and the architects feverishly hurrying up the internal stuff that's going on. We have decided on an open house. It will be Saturday, September 24th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. So please mark your calendars. You all should be there. And including the ribbon cutting that day as well. And then operationally, we should be operational by probably the first week of October. So it's called statue running.
No, you didn't.
Oh, that's statute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't spell right. Okay. Oh, okay. So usually Brian proofs this for me. He didn't proof it this time.
What if I spell check too?
No, spell right? Check, right?
Yeah, it still passes.
Still passes.
So it should be statute.
Statue. Statue.
Yeah.
So just so you know where we're at with the statue.
We were going to clean that. I
would work it for Vermont. He totally would. I'm actually surprised he's trying not to furiously look right on the board. So you may see, if you're looking at the front of the new PD, to the left, you'll see this big thing sticking out that's a square. That's where the statue is going on top of, just so you know. The good news is I took a drive up to where the artist is working on our statue, and there were various parts of each of the dog and the kids and the officer that were all around his shop. And so it is getting done, which is great news. And he promises me that it will be done by the time the open house. Oh, that's exciting. I am hoping that he is going to be able to give me a miniature of the statue prior to all of this, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, so that I can actually give it to you guys and show you. So I just don't want to promise anything.
They do it more than 1 minute?
House will start promoting it here in the next couple of weeks, but it is, because it is before we're moving in, we don't have all of the state mandated privacy requirements because we haven't moved anything in there. So for the community to know, it will be a wide open to get every nook and cranny, and we're going to try and set it up so everybody can get a sense as they walk through of what each of these areas are. So it's a really great opportunity, not only to see the new building, but really to get a great sense of what this department does and where we are.
Are you going to have a buffet or something like that?
Did you say buffet?
Yeah.
So when, you know, we had a meeting, Ann and myself and Kim and Mike Peterson, and the first question, I think Mike or Ann asked, well, are we going to have refreshments? And of course, my panic said, well, can we have water? Just water, because I'm afraid people are going to
spill.
So we'll have water, John.
Well, in the parking lot. I think I'm in a parking lot.
Yeah. I don't want your new facility to get all with punch and stuff, I'm worried. Anyway. Okay, so you know that we have several Tri-City partnerships that we do, and one of which is the mental health social worker, which is, as I've told and Brian has told you several times, is going very well. And I think I mentioned this to you, New Hope Police Department is asking for a full-time mental health social worker. I'm attempting to do the same. However, if New Hope gets it, for example, then we would be sharing solo with Robinson, just so that you know about that. Our current social worker actually is done as of tomorrow, because she received a new job in the county. And I just met a couple of days ago our new social worker, who is just as fantastic. So we're excited to get her aboard. And then Pete, as you know, talked about West Metro SWAT. We still have that great partnership going on with Robbinsdale and New Hope. And then the Joint Community Police Partnership Program, we did find out that New Hope and Robbinsdale are going to share a advocate. And Hennepin County is actually, we just had an email that went out to several cities, not just in Hennepin County, but other cities in other counties, promoting joint community police partnerships because of the success of the program.
Well, the social worker, is the job very taxing working for three cities?
Yeah, so I'll just give you, you know, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'll just tell you that she's very busy. It is too much for one person to take on.
So even if we go to sharing this person with Robinsdale, it's still going to be like, monumentous job, right?
And it's one of those things where you look at what the what you're capable of doing, and you have to stop it based on what you can do. If we had more resources to dedicate to that, certainly we're going to be able to serve more people and bridge. A great example recently that's come up is we have an adult with some significant special needs in the city. And we have for about a year been dealing with a pretty continual, he's low functioning, but moves and he is leaving his residence pretty constantly. So we are cop officers, sometimes 4 or 5 times a week, are getting calls to the missing person. We are scouring the area. He can make some tracks. And so we are continuing to chase and get him, and eventually get him back. And because we have a social worker in play, we have been able to bring Ash into the mix here to get all of the other providers together to say, we got to find something else, because at some point we're crossing 81, we're ending up talking to people at Planet Fitness who don't know who you are. This is going to go badly. But we don't, our officers are simply trying to get you home safely, but it's not solving the problem. We're just kicking the can down the road. Having a resource like this, now we've had a number of meetings where now we're going to get this person correct supports. And we can be just behind that. Like, what does that allow the officers to do? It frees them up literally on some of these for hours to be engaging in other things because they're not continuing to follow up to see. That's just one example of a number that we've had since we've had this position. But again, how deep they can go is really based on how many calls for service these three cities have that they have to follow.
Okay.
And then finally, our community engagement. As you all know, as I know, Ann has reached out to all of you about Minnesota Night to Unite, which is Tuesday, August 2nd. You know that you get to ride along with us with the police and have some fun that night. And then I think I may have given you the date for our community forum for the Tri-City, Robbinsdale, and New Hope and Crystal, which will be Wednesday, October 12th at 6:30 in the community center. And then also what I forgot to put up here is our Community Police Academy, which starts in September, which we have started to promote on social media and will continue to promote it. I think we went from a 6-week to a 9-week. Did I read that? Maybe, no, I'm dreaming. 6-week program, once a week for 3 hours a day, 3 hours at night from usually 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Any questions?
Andrea?
I don't have a question, but I just want to acknowledge that you start talking about the new building, Chief Revering, and you are beaming.
I know.
You don't smile the rest of the presentation. You just, when you're talking about the new building and your happiness is contagious.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, Councilmember Kaiser, because I really can't thank you all enough for approving this building. I had the great pleasure of just walking my father, who is visiting from Arizona, in, and as you know, he's a retired police chief, in it today. Just for, couldn't go downstairs, but he was looking at it from the upstairs, and he turned to me and he said, "I can't believe that you were able to get this done." I said, "Well, I didn't get it done. It was the council that got it done." And he said, "Well, you should be proud of yourself, because this is a great building." And so when you say that, I'm smiling mainly because of my dad being proud of me, but also because of all of you allowing us to do this, and the community allowing us to do it. So thank you.
Many of you have met Senior Chief Reverend. Senior Chief Reverend thinks that Junior Chief Reverend's office is too small.
It's too late. We can't make any more changes. We can't make any more changes.
I have a sledgehammer.
Oh, that's funny.
Don't tell him.
That's funny. That's awesome. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Name tags on the table over there.
Yep.
Pull up a chair. Yes, we did.
I was trying to squish it with me, so shame on me.
Name tags are on the table up over to your left. Excellent. All right.
Olga's online, and so is one of the commissioners.
Okay. All right, next item on the work session is the Crystal Cove Aquatic Center. We're going to start with John.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Mayor.
Good evening.
Members.
We're here tonight to get some direction on the next steps of the Crystal Cove Aquatic Center. We've been here a number of times to talk about the leak that is happening right now, improvements that have happened in the past. And so we're just looking for a little bit of clarification today. So as you may recall, the pool was built back in the late 60s. Back in around 2005, there were some improvements needed. And the pool was in poor condition at that time. And similar question was posed at that time. And residents voted to improve to put money in to improve the pool. However, the approved amount did not cover all of the needed improvements, and namely the deep end of the pool, which is leaking now. So back then, $3.2 million was put into the pool, $2.4 million from the referendum. In today's dollars, that's around $6 million. But the new features, all new mechanical, zero-depth pool, drop slide, water walk, family changing rooms. But we've noticed the pool leaking over the past number of years. So we did hire a consultant to come in and take a look and let us know what's the status of the pool. So their professional opinion, the swimming pool structure is at the end of its life, and that's the deep end in the old container. But everything else is in great condition. So all the improvements back made in 2005 is functioning properly. So the question then is, with that leaking pool, something needs to be done. So do we continue to provide water safety swimming services in Crystal by replacing the pool and then making some improvements at the entry? Or do we do something else? And something else would involve removing the existing pool facility and then identifying other use for the space, which would be typically to identify what else. That's a master planning process. But just to kind of go over what happens there today, we do have a robust swimming lesson program, 63 lessons, 438 students. We were able to add some staff partway through the year, and we were able to, a swim instructor can teach so many students, but then if they have an aide, you can teach more. So we put those new staff into the aide role. So we had this little, pretty good list of waiting list folks wanting lessons. So we're able to pull them off the waiting list and get them into lessons. We know New Hope's similar situation, their lessons are full as well. So lessons are definitely something that is desired in the community. We have a lot of summer adventure clubs and groups, 22 groups come through, and they can range up to 150 people. We get the big yellow school buses roll in and all the kids in the same colored shirts roll out. So we have 1,635 people in those groups. We also are a host for birthday parties. We offer a birthday party package where people can get a hot dog and chips and a soda and I think an ice cream. And you have to so many kids. And then they come out and have their birthday party at the pool. And then also early in the mornings, we have the New Hope Crystal Plymouth NHCP Swim Club. So they're out there in the mornings doing their thing. And it was pointed out to me recently, I did not know this, that they are the Class A state champions, 2022. So, and then of course, Saturday mornings, we have our Little Splashers program. That's a time where we let the little kids come in without the big kids being around. Very popular program. Parents kind of appreciate having that time where it's not quite as chaotic as it could be other times. And then the open swim. And I just put the June numbers because I have them. So our use is up about 1,000 from in June from last year. So we know last year was kind of a down year. I don't know that we're going to get back to what it was back in, a few years ago this year, but things are, use is increasing.
Do you know what that number is?
What number is that?
The number you just referred to. Prior to the last couple of years?
I was in the 26,000-ish, 22, over 20,000 a year, I believe is the number. I don't have it handy.
Okay.
And then this is a sheet you've been provided. I don't know that it, you could go through it a whole lot, but if you have any questions on it, you can certainly answer them. And then just kind of where pool users come from. So the annual pass holders, this is last year's data because we're not done with this year. But the majority of annual pass holders come from Crystal. Close, Robbinsdale is another significant location for where annual pass holders come from. And the swim lessons, Crystal, Robbinsdale, and actually Golden Valley. So we have a reciprocal agreement with Golden Valley where we give them resident rates here, and then we get resident rates at their indoor playground. So we have that reciprocal agreement. So they come on down here for swim lessons. And a lot of non-residents, I think those are probably folks just across the border in Brooklyn Center. Not, we don't have the data on exactly where they're from. But anyway, the Park and Recreation Commission back in February reviewed a whole lot of different things, and the memo that kind of highlights all the things they talked about is in your packet. And the motion there was to go ahead and make the improvements at Aquatic Center. And then at the same time, we also went out to talk to residents, recognized we couldn't really get at the what else should we do through a survey. We just went with, do you think improvement should be made at the pool? So, you know, the importance of children to learn how to swim at an early age. There was a national survey done a few years ago, and that said national 95%. This one's a little less than that. This is at 88%. I think that it's important for kids to learn how to swim. And then replacing the old swimming pool and diving well, a lot of support, 85% in favor of replacing the pool facility. So the next steps are really two, and I put a third other just in case, but you know, do we move forward with fixing the pool? It's the focus of the pool is we know kids, too many kids drown. And so this provides that service to teach kids how to swim, to try to keep our residents knowing how to swim. Or if you want to, you know, look further into the what else, we could begin a community engagement process to update the city's park system master plan to specifically look at the Aquatic Center. Master plans typically take around a year to complete. So thoughts, questions?
All right. Questions, anyone? Go ahead, Therese.
I know you told us this before, John. I don't remember. So now the pool is operating and just leaking water.
Correct. And it's leaking more this year, I think, than it was last year.
And how many gallons is it leaking?
I don't know. It needs to be fixed or do something else.
18,000 gallons a day-ish, probably.
And that's treated with a lot of chlorine.
Correct.
That's not good.
Forrest.
This is a more technical question. I didn't see it in the packet, but is there the exact wording of the question that they asked? The support question? Because here it says, rather than ask if they would support or oppose the improvements, do we have that exact wording anywhere?
I do. Okay. I don't have it in front of me right now. Okay. But sorry, I meant to grab it and I forgot. I'll see if I can find it while I'm sitting here.
Nancy.
Question for you as a commission. Have you been, talking about community engagement, have you been asking or polling the residents you're talking to at your outdoor summer park meetings? Just wondering if there was a way to get some other info from people. I really like the idea of option two. Just to get a little more feedback. To Forrest's point, we requested those questions at our last work session, I believe. So they alluded to it a little bit, but it wasn't the direct question asked, I think, or they didn't submit that in that report early on. So I was just wondering, Lynn.
Okay, first of all, I'm at the meeting at the park without knowing what questions we wanted to ask. Isn't really something that we have done.
No, but I thought.
At the park meeting.
Right, just wondering if it's been discussed at all, if any residents have asked or. Okay.
Not the NASA.
Exactly.
I have. Great. I have talked to the neighborhood on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, you know, when we did Becker Park and we had those engagement meetings with, you had the little dots and things where people right. could add suggestions. Yeah. That's why I really like the idea of option two to get more feedback, because I think that'd be more of a direct response than this, maybe more accurate. I'm not sure, not accurate, but just a reaching out to a broader audience.
Yeah. So I think it was talked about when we did the master plan 5 years ago, but there was really no interest then to do anything different. And I get contacted all the time about people wanting to do different things in the parks.
Right.
You know, we kind of went back to them. I think one was, I have a year-round pool. You know, that's one I hear every once in a while is, hey, can't we have this year-round? But aside from that, they're really, you know, I haven't heard anything.
Or features that people say they'd love to see, say a splash pad option. If the pool had to close, the kids, people coming there could still do something, you know. I don't know, just curious. But I really do like the community engagement process idea.
Go ahead, John.
We know that I see these soccer domes, you know, so that they can play soccer all year round. I mean, is that an option for the pool? I mean, having some type of like temporary structure over it, you know, so that we can use it, you know, more than just, you know, 3 months out of the year.
I think the thing, if you enclose it, you've got chemical issues floating around. So there's some HVAC exhaust issues to make sure that, you know, the chemicals can get out of the air.
Don't overwhelm your
your
participants. Okay, all right. And then if I can ask one other question. So you from your presentation, it looks like you have a lot of people that are coming to our pool specifically and choosing our pool as opposed to going to New Hope.
Correct.
And I guess my question is why? Why would they pick our pool, right? You know. Right.
Well, I think the main thing is it's close to home.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, that's the thing when you talk about pools is, you know, you need to have them close, especially with the population we have here. Is, you know, if we weren't able to do swim lessons, we know New Hope's are full. You know, then do they go to Foss and Lane, or, you know, where do they go for that kind of a thing? So, you know, it's really kind of the first question is, do we still want to offer swim lessons and that type of thing? Mm-hmm. And then if the answer is no, then what?
Well, I think you had a great point there where you said that you had a waiting list of people who mm-hmm. wanted to take lessons here. And then by adding an aid so that the class size could grow, you were able to provide this service to the community, which is great. One question that came to me was that, I mean, are the lessons only specifically at a certain time during the day? Do we have other hours? Do we have other, ways that we can offer lessons on the weekend, things like that, because a lot of times, parents, their schedules don't really match up well with being able to provide lessons, and then they have to look for other, go to Foss or go to the Y or something like that, So, I mean, how would you?
Yeah, so part of that is staffing too, because right now it's a 4-hour block of time, Monday through Friday. So it's a 5-day work day.
Okay.
So if you start doing weekends, then it's, it's trying to staff a 7-day with instructors.
Sure.
And that's a different scenario. And then we have tried them in the evening. They've been less successful.
Okay.
And part of that is you've got then a split shift. So your instructors come and then they go home and then they come back again.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a little bit harder for staffing.
Yeah. I was looking at that in terms of staff being the issue. Why they're full in both places right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is our challenge, and it makes this whole conversation difficult to have when we're in this environment, because we can't get a real good picture as to what's really going on or what's going to go on long term. Saw a bunch of hands. Go ahead, Aaron.
I think respectfully, I don't think the point to this for us to try to I mean, I think the answer can be yes, and not have $1 million investment into the infrastructure. Going back to Nancy's question, I think part of where I personally struggled is that there wasn't any alternative. Like, if we're going to go up to the community, it's helpful to be specific in the request, or to say, to provide those illustrations, to say, we can spend Becker Park costs $3 million. We could have another Becker Park, or we can do a slide, or we can do other things, or we can invest in people. So I think to have that going the importance of the swimming lessons. I don't know that we've ever seriously explored other partnerships that we're going to live on. Like in this, we have, you know, other resources, we have other public or private or Courage Center and Canadian Fields and more that they know. But I guess I don't believe that it's an all or nothing scenario. And but where I really struggle with the lack of alternatives to be
Go ahead, Lynn.
Going back to one of the things John asked, why are people going to crypto and not, why not do both? Because it's new and it has so much more to offer. It's I talked to one family who went there to see what it was like, and they left in 15 minutes because it was so crowded. They did not feel safe. And I'm not saying it's not safe. That was there. That was her words, not my words and not the actual situation. But she said it was so crowded. They came back and felt so late. And she said it was crowded, but it wasn't packed. So she said, when I said what would happen if we didn't have a pool with her, so she said, we wouldn't go to New Hope. New Hope would be so crowded, it would be even more somebody found. So that's one of the reasons people are coming back.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Great point. And when this pool goes under construction next year, you're not going to have it. So where are people going to go? Till during construction, they're going to go to New Hope or
the construction happens without necessarily.
Off-season,
Well, that's a good point.
And you know, I would say also that if we looked for a different purpose, it doesn't mean there isn't going to be another purpose that serves trying to stay cool on a hot summer day. I mean, that could still exist in some level, some fashion, which might take up some of that slack. You know, I don't know how, just one of my biases, I didn't go to the Crystal Pool very much. It wasn't open when I was able to go. And I think in all three of my kids' lives, we made it there, I think three times, maybe two. It's not that we didn't try. It's just that the way our life was constructed with working full-time jobs, get home and try to get something accomplished in that realm, it didn't happen. But that being said, we still had the YMCA. There were still other options open to us. And I understand recreation is something that's vital to our community. And I understand the importance of lessons. And maybe this isn't going to be a popular viewpoint, but is it really a service that we as a city are going to make sure that as many people learn how to swim in this community as possible? And that kind of struck me when we looked at the survey that it was focused really on swim lessons, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, of course everybody wants their kids to learn how to swim. But is it necessarily recreation's role to actually do that? So I don't know. That just struck me during the survey. Go ahead, Jesse.
Yeah, you know, I remember from the previous work session that there was a lot of discussion about the different aspects of the survey. And I think there were multiple parts to the questions that were asked. And I'm just looking at one right now. This is part of the question that was asked. The main swimming pool and diving well are now leaking and need to be replaced. Respondents were asked if they would support or oppose these improvements. And so I think part of the question that they were being asked was directly, do you think this $3 million should go into fixing the main pool? And that's where we have this 85% support. So, you know, different parts are maybe a little bit ambiguous, and whether we needed to identify, do citizens really value parks and recreation services in Crystal? That's something that can be discussed as well. But there is this question, which I would imagine that respondents understood. They were being asked directly, do you want the $3 million to go into the main swimming pool? And that's where we have this 85% support.
Yeah, I would look at that. I looked at that completely different. The way it was worded was, we saved this money for the pool. Should we use it or not? That's a completely different question. I mean, the way it was phrased was, we have this money. It's in our plan. Should we follow our plan or not? That's completely different. That's not really giving the alternative.
But I think people can infer the alternative that if the money is not spent on the pool, it would be spent on something else. It's not as though this money will just go somewhere else. Yeah, it would be used for something else, like a splash pad or somewhere completely different in the city. I think that we can trust that people will identify that there are other options. And I think the survey asked them quite directly, do you want this money to go towards this use or not?
Yeah, I think I disagree, but go ahead.
Can you just tell me again, how is the question worded on the survey?
Would you like me to read the question?
I have, yes, right, please.
It says, the survey initially reminded in 2005, the city of Crystal passed a park bond referendum to upgrade the aquatic center by adding a zero depth pool, filtration system, drop slide, and water walk. The main swimming pool and diving well, which were not part of the 2005 improvements, are now leaking and need to be replaced. The cost of replacing the 50-year-old pool and diving and making security improvements to the aquatic center's entrance is $3 million. The city has money set aside for this work, so a property tax increase would not be necessary. Respondents were then asked if they would support or oppose these improvements.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's ambiguous at all.
Except for the fact that it wasn't approved in that plan. It was just placed, it was a placeholder put there by staff. It wasn't put there by the council. That's a huge difference.
Olga.
Olga.
Hi, sorry, I'm on Zoom tonight. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Okay. So really quick about the survey, I don't think the survey was ambiguous. It was very clear, and the questions were very direct. I do think that the questions, the survey did not leave room for any other option. So it was like self-selecting results based on the questions. So I, along with Nancy, do favor, on the next steps, option two here. I think we really do need a community engagement process that's pretty rigorous and holistic and has more context. I don't think we should have a soccer field or like whatever instead of the pool, like an enclosed, anything that's, I think most people will favor some kind of water feature. And there's so many possibilities with the money that we have, to explore for this, that I really think we'll be doing ourselves a huge disservice by not beginning a community engagement process and see where we can go with this. So that's that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Forrest?
Yeah. So on the survey topic, this is an area that personally I have quite a bit of expertise in. I got my master's degree specifically, and like a large portion of it was evaluation, survey, item writing. And I do this at work as well quite often. Referred to as somebody that will write items for surveys from the board. And the one problem is we don't have the question ultimately. Like the question that is asked is not there. So it can be a little difficult to know exactly, is there measurement error, is there not measurement error? However, looking at this and the way that the firm wrote the survey results, I mean, they did say they were asked if they support or oppose. And that's like the most important rule in item writing is that you were asking both positive and negative. It's like the easiest way to remove bias. And even if there was bias in the lead up, just the results are incredible. I mean, over 80% on this large of a sample, I mean, that is beyond statistical. And like measurement error, you can measure that. Like, if you wanted, you could probably go back to the firm and say, hey, let's test these questions. You can do that. it's something that happens. But I'm sure the firm would find that the measurement error is less than the confidence. It wouldn't alter the confidence to a level where we would say, this is a measure. I believe that with this, if it was closer, maybe 50%, 51, 40%, you know, something like that, I'd be more nervous with measurement error. But just this amount, it is quite bigger, the high level.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So talking about number two in terms of, you know, next steps, you know, a community engagement process. I mean, that's pretty ambiguous. I mean, how would you go about, you know, even, you know, do you have any ideas as to how you would tackle something like that? Yeah,
so it'd be just very similar to how we did the park system master plan. We'd hire a firm, probably the same firm, since they have a lot of the history with that. And there's, you know, we had focus group meetings, we had a lot of neighborhood meetings, a lot of online engagement, things like that.
So what is the timeline for something like that?
Typically about a year.
About a year, you said a year. And so basically we'd be back here again next year. It'd probably be more than 18,000 gallons a day, correct? You know, right? There's no way to like ramp that up and make it quicker than that, because obviously you want to build this. If you're going to do a pool, right, we're going to build it during the winter time, correct? I mean, we're going to
I think the goal, and our consultant seems to think it would be feasible, is to start like late August.
Okay.
Get half of it done by October and then finish it up in the spring before the pool opens.
Probably would lose a season.
If the window is shrinking to do that, but you know, we'd be waiting a year
again. So if we go with number two, we create this engagement process where we hire a firm, we wouldn't start this, we wouldn't, whatever process or whatever decision we make in terms of what happens would not begin until August of next year, correct?
Yeah, sometime summer,
right? We might even end up with the same answer that we have now, correct?
Good. Aaron, sorry.
So during the engagement, do you concern what you're
I guess I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Therese.
Hey, John, if you could just ballpark for us, what would the engagement process cost? Hiring the firm to conduct and holding all the meetings. I'm not saying it's not money well spent, just
yes. So the citywide one, I think, was in the like $40,000 range. And then we spent for each of the community parks, we did a deeper dive, and I think that was another $40,000 total. So it was about, that was about $80,000. So I think we'd be more in the 40.
Okay, thank you.
Thousand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Lynn, go ahead.
The other thing to think about, when you're talking $3 million, wow, we could put this $3 million towards something else. How much is going to have to be put into thinking through how taking off everything else and getting rid of it? You're not going to have $3 million. So saying that you have $3 million to put into another veteran park type situation, that isn't going to be there. Because you're going to have to remove all of it. The pipes, you've got all the chemicals and all of that kind of thing that's going to have to be dealt with.
So it's not going to be the really critical. Yeah. We do understand that. I understand that anyway.
I don't think they remember that part of the cost to get rid of it all too.
And it's not just the capital side, that's multidimensional as well. And when you look at operations, and you look at the environmental costs and all these things, you know, There's quite a bit to consider. It's not just the capital piece. So yeah, I get that. Thank you.
Vanessa? Yeah, just a question. The deep pool, if that were closed next year, can you still operate the rest of the pool, or is it all connected, like with the slide area? And
well, the slide area goes into the same container.
Yep.
So that would be no slide. So you're talking, would you just open the pool for the zero depth?
The zero depth.
I don't know if that's worth it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
So I don't own a pool, but I'm assuming that we don't completely drain the pool in the wintertime. Is that correct?
We leave some in the deep end.
Okay.
So things don't freeze.
Okay. All right. So if...
Although we add water in the winter too, because that... drains.
Well, yeah, you're constantly adding water to it. I'm just trying to think of, like, I mean, if you totally drain the pool and then you're waiting to get an answer, that would just add to the deterioration of the pool, right?
Yeah, when you don't fill a pool, it deteriorates. Yeah. Deteriorates faster.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. Any other comments, Tony?
I think it's still fix the pool now, but I think number two is having to do with therapists with the whole community center complex. The master plan bosses over it saying that we just have here, but some meetings happen in the pool, we've never had another office beside the community center. But I don't think the master plan really got that correct. That's such a big part of our investment program. I think we need to go back and visit that regardless.
Yeah, I think we have a breath of time here where we can do that.
I wasn't saying today. No.
But you know, I share some concerns as to what's going on up there. That, you know, it should be busy, it should be vibrant, you know. And I know we're coming off of COVID and stuff where we had everything shut down, but boy, we got to get that back. We got to make that a place that's vibrant on a daily. Yeah, go ahead.
Two comments. One, I think kind of going back to the question, while the question was right, the question wasn't ambiguous, but I don't necessarily, not that it was leading, but I think what I feel like the general consensus of the issue was that there was no other option provided. It was basically saying, we have $3 million to fix the pool. Do you want to do it or not? You know, versus we have $3 million in the parks budget we can fix the pool or we can reimagine this space, right? And do we want to try to reimagine this space or do we want to fix the pool? And that question wasn't asked, right?
Or sorry. I can say this because I got a call. Mm-hmm. anyway, they did say that one of the freshmen said it does get a lot of money in front of you. But if the option of not fixing the pool was open the pool, that question is in there.
Right. Again, my question, the thing and what was stated and what still wasn't presented, I think what was asked, and please don't interrupt me anymore, let me finish, is can we reimagine this space, right? Or can we do something else? And what I'm feeling is that's what some of the biggest consensus of really going back to number, like kind of why I think people are leaning towards number two. And so I'll lead into kind of where I stand personally, right? I guess just because I'm biased. And now we continue to make significant investment into the infrastructure of the parks, you know, system. I don't feel like anybody, and I wouldn't approve of going away from that, right? That I would want to continue to make that investment and to continue to do that. I think I personally would probably say, how can we fix the pool? Is that feasible? Is that what the community really wants? I think I'm more in the holistic place of, is this really what the community wants? Is this the best spend for our money? Or, and then kind of leading into even like what Tony was saying, in that space, right? It's kind of, hodgepodge, right? If you know, I've spent a lot of time at the ball fields over there, you know, and they're kind of in their own little space. And I know redoing the parking lot's going to help kind of everything, but then you got the community center itself. And even then it's kind of sectioned. Then you've got the skate park, and then you've got, you know, and then you have the pool, right? Is there something that we have an opportunity of making a significant investment to, can we reimagine that and continue to like look ahead, not look at what we have right now, but what's in the next 30 years, you know, and being a little bit more forward thinking, not saying that not having a pool is that option, but also taking the opportunity to say, what is it that ultimately that our community wants and that we're continuing to, as we're continuing to make and, you know, be committed to significant, you know, funding to this, that it's the right, not just, okay, well, here's this, I'm in my bubble and I think this is what it should be. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of what we do. Does that make any sense? I know I kind of, yeah. There was, it was leading.
Yeah. Is that going to John?
Yeah, I know he wanted to respond.
Yeah, but I'm just going to say, you know, the reason the survey was done the way it was is because you can't ask what else would you like to see in a survey. That's not a very effective way to get at what you're looking at a holistic thing. So I think the question out of that last work session was, you know, let's get a pulse of what the community thinks about the pool. So that was what the attempt was with survey, recognizing that if we want to do a deeper dive, we could do that, but that is a year-long process. And it's, you know, so the intent was really to get a pulse on, hey, what do people think of the pool? And if we had 40% said fix it, well, then it's an easy answer. You know, we could just go on and do a master plan, but, you know, it came out a little different, but that was the reason behind it. It was, you know, talk to the Park and Rec Commission, get a survey sample of what the public thinks. And then we can always do number two, if you want to do number two and do the year long process to evaluate other options.
Okay, Nancy.
Are there other options than the 1 year wait with this firm? Is there any way we could expedite it or do it a little differently to speed it up?
Well, you know, you're still talking maybe 9 or 10 months. I mean, you're not going to significant, because you need to do surveys, you need to talk to people, you need to go out to the community and have meetings, and you generally try to get a bunch of ideas and then you kind of narrow that down over time. And to do it right, it takes time. It's not, you know, fill out a postcard and, you know, check it out.
Just wondering if an online survey or something,
that would be another part of option. It. Yeah. That would be part of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Erin.
I just really appreciate the call back to that park. I think there was some resistance to changing the record park and just look at how strategic thinking and investment in the community. It's a fantastic long-term investment into our landscape and the pool, but they would have to be part, and it's just been such a revitalization of our city and our community. And so I just work that I think that's great long-term strategic thinking about, like, if we started with the landscape, would we make this decision? I don't mind to really know, but, you know, until we kind of
all right, Joyce.
Yeah, I just want to be part of this. I'm thinking of this concern about spending. So I guess I want to just invite them to do more thorough research and the community involved. And we also want to consider the opportunity to get involved. How in school, I know John mentioned, you know, the involvement of kids learning how to swim at a very early age. But we need to consider to the elderly population. I have people using the pool for pool. You know, with the pool, we have people asking about the pool. A lot of people are very, you know, So I believe the city, will have not only day-to-day health, and we are talking mental health. It's very huge in Bermuda, and we don't think it's too problematic. And these are things that stress people, health, depression, all of them. So we really need to do our research, see what the opportunity comes before if that happens. And also, if there is, for those that have concern about spending this money on this food, what are the alternatives that we can compete having this habitat? You see, and we also want to consider what the name mentioned. She talked about a lot of people going over to the new home. You have a family living in a kid's room, and that's another concern. So if people are finding the new home, what impact is this having? So after feeling the well-being of our citizens, very important. And we kind of look at it from a more holistic point of view, looking at a youth. Some of them are officers. So if they don't have access to the community, we kind of look at it from a crime perspective too. We then lead them into other stuff. So let us go back and do a world sort of legal research. Let the community involved in Christopher coming up, people at the table.
Yep.
And have a lot of people go over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at a better part, you know, and that would be, I mean, a good start. You know, then the community involved. And I don't have better part. That part is so much food, and I'm so happy. You go there and see the community, people coming from all over the place. I don't know. So could it be that if this pool is improved, it will be a center of attraction, making not only the non-resident, but bring even more funds for the city. So instead of credits for thorough research, that really can make an informed decision that everything was put on the table, was reviewed for that, and then unanimous decision of being so that no other is then out.
And Joyce, you spoke so eloquently about what I brought up at that last meeting, is that I love the pool, but I feel it's underserving the community. It's also not, is used by, say, seniors and some other people, adults or whatever. I'd like to see options out there. If we're going to make this, and to Brendan's point too, can we reimagine some things so that it is used more and it's serving more?
Just one quick thing. I know there's a lot of concern about the pool leaking 18,000 gallons a day. It has been leaking a lot of water for a very long time, like prior to me starting here. So don't let that be this false pressure on the conversation. You know, to Joyce's point, do the due diligence, meet the community where they're at, regardless of their ability or age. You know, work through that process and don't let, yes, it's leaking. Yes, that's annoying. It's been doing that a long time. So don't let that influence, create a false sense of urgency, basically. Meet the community's needs where it is.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Forrest.
Yeah. We're talking a lot about engagement, getting people engaged in this process, we truly understand what the city feels, but it seems like there's a large portion that really don't think that the survey did what it was supposed to do, which is tell us what we was thinking, right? And, you know, community engagement serves a lot of different needs in the planning process, right? It's not just hearing from the community, it's also telling the community. That's part of why it's so long, right? Because you're out there doing a lot of community outreach. But if all we really want to know is what exactly is the community thinking drilled down on some of these hard questions that you can't do in a survey, because you can't ask a ton of open-ended questions in a survey and get good results. It's just not really possible. But there are firms out there that do focus groups. And this is something that DNR uses for complex topics. And the timeline is much, much shorter than community engagement because you're not doing that massive outreach as well. You're kind of selecting a representative sample of the population, bringing them in, and then drilling down on these hard issues.
in a conversation way that, and you can get statistical significance folks first. So that just popping up, it's the thing, the majority of the council is thinking it's got to be community engagement or nothing, but the timeline's so long, I mean, that's just another option.
Yeah, for the master park system master plan, we started with focus groups and then kind of went into said, okay, this is what the focus groups kind of came up with. You know, what are your thoughts on that? So then it went kind of into a more of a public engagement kind of a process.
I just have
John, go ahead.
So Forrest, even with your proposal, we would still have to have some type of you know, mass community engagement that would have to happen.
So focus groups can be done like the survey under the radar. John might be able to answer better how he would want to see it, but yeah, it doesn't necessarily need to be an
outreach. And then the focus group, let's take that for a ride. So if we did this focus group method of determining what's a good outcome, what's the timeline for that? Is it, you know, is it a month, is it 30?
Really, it can depend. Sometimes you can have a really good population that's really easy to get hold of and they're really excited. But often, if you really want to get a representative sample in your focus groups targeted, it can be hard. Good firms do it well with incentives and, you know, they'll like knock on the door and ask them to join focus groups. But it could be months. Or it could be like half a year, but generally it is much shorter than a full communication process.
Because going back to what Mark said, I mean, you know, it's not like overnight, you know, we had this problem. This problem's been there for a while. So, you know, true, we'd like to get a quick decision. So if we're going to fix the pool, we'd be able to start here within, I don't know, 30, 60 days, right? We'd be able to do half. And then the other half next year sometime. So I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of a quick and easy answer. Everybody does. But this is government. I mean, even us moving at breakneck speed, you know, sometimes it takes a long time. So I don't know. I think the idea of going with, you know, community engagement process, following the master park plan, but specifically for that, you know, for that part of our park and rec system and get it going. I mean, I want us to come to a decision tonight and move forward. So that's my opinion.
Okay. Go ahead.
I love the idea of the frolics coming up with Family Day and other opportunities for people to participate. Mm-hmm. Like you had the sandwich board up or the posters up couple years ago, people really loved that. I remember it was very well appreciated. People like to be heard. And I think you've got a great audience right there.
So we don't have a consultant hired yet.
No, but could we do something?
Oh, some type of awareness?
Yeah.
Just an awareness thing, maybe. Sure. Say, hey, we're looking at doing this.
This is get coming. People,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this is coming is a big, big, big deal.
Mm-hmm. Without Jesse. Skewing the results, correct? You know, kind of like.
I was just going to say that the frolics are in 2 weeks.
Right.
That would be time quick. To even yeah. get something.
An awareness poster, something up there, you know, something to tell people, hey, we've got this coming. Start yeah. thinking about no, what you'd like to see.
There's ways we could do that. We did that with the master plan. I think we were out at Winterfest.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we just had some post-it notes and just to get some initial thoughts on
exactly
where people are at.
So. I know it's 2 weeks away or not even that, but
right.
It'd be great to just get some an awareness campaign going. You've got a captive group of locals and
okay. I think we're at
one just, more comment. Yeah, just thinking about this and I'm excited for like the community engagement process, kind of some people's points about maybe we have like a Becker Park in pool form in waiting. So that kind of excites me. Hopefully we can get it done quicker and, you know, whatever way possible. It's kind of interesting. I wonder if it was more of a point in the park master plan, we wouldn't be in this situation if there was like a roadmap more on that part, but you know, it's a big document, right? There's a lot of pieces and parts to it, but, that's definitely a weak point in that thing, and maybe we can get that sorted out, you know, with the community engagement. And maybe we'll have something really cool to, you know, build and create for residents here and, you know, in the near future.
I don't think, you know, I don't think 5 years ago we really knew to the extent of what the problem was. So this is, again, just something that kind of has changed. It's a situation that changed from our perspective. Whose hand did I see?
Aaron.
Aaron.
just a request that, so to that point, the voter resolution or like providing direction, if we can encapsulate the community center and pull together, I think that would be beneficial to fill that gap, and then also the technical kind of commission with the space and its totality would be, I think that would be beneficial.
Okay. So we're not taking a vote. However, that is noted. I'm getting a census for option two. I'd like to at least see some head nods if people are interested in two.
I'd like to say something before we get there.
Quickly, yeah.
I'll be really quick. I think the time is of the essence. I know Marcus said 18,000 gallons a day leaking has been doing that a long time. Then fix that. That's chlorinated water. That's not good for the groundwater. Yep. John said he wanted to take a pulse of the community, and the statistical expert or survey expert, Forrest, had said it was a good survey. I understand. I'd like to have more time to do an in-depth engagement with the community. I just don't think we have it. The pulse, you know, you took the pulse, the survey guy said it was good. I say move forward and fix the pool. That's my thought.
I don't think the timing is that much different, but so saw some nods. Any nods out here? Or two? Yeah. Over here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think we'll move forward with that. I'm not sure what we have to do at the council level to do that forward. I think there'll be funding.
I got it.
I got it.
Thank you.
I was prepared for both. You're prepared for both, huh?
Yeah. And that's what we do in Parks and Rec, is community engagement. So,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll get that rolling.
You do a great job.
All right.
Thank you.
So, we're done with the Crystal Cove Aquatics. Bassett Creek Park is next. We're going to take a 5-minute recess. We've been going for over an hour and a half. I need a quick break.
You're entitled.
Oh, we're just taking a break because you want a break.
That's right.
I guess
he gets it.
Joys of being the mayor, right?
Right, exactly.
It's not elevated.
What are you doing? Hey, I got some E&Ps up here.
No, I'm going. Oh, no,
let me know. Hanging out? Going?
Hey, what did Dave say? Didn't he work on the original pool?
You're also looking
voted at on the referendum.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Must have been a tough vote, right?
No. Oh, you know, oh, yeah, you turned around. The worst was he thought that's everything, $4 million that we went out and voters for, and then we have to throw all the deep end, we have to throw all the building, and then we had to put in the money we were expecting. We sort of kept them together. It was off.
Yeah.
It was on the slide.
Yeah.
Out of. It's kind of hard. There, you know, half of it's worked great.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's kind of hard to go like, okay, let's scrap the whole thing.
Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
why not? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Assuming you can get staff, you can get all that.
back when they used to drive those junkers, you know, and have like a leaky radiator or some stuff, and then and it would kind of stop. But you know, you would never have any heat in the winter. Nice. Can we do something like that?
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Nice idea.
Oh God, we did all the like we have that. Those are the
hospitals. Yeah.
We talked about. Remember we talked about goats for a while.
Remember Mark saying like you know, take like a month to go just to get the thing ready.
Oh, that may not.
You know, there is
so there are great assets, but they are really maintenance. Yep. Things. So we put in a grant for both.
Okay, yes. Sir.
Remember the fence by?
Yes, I was just thinking.
So I got a call from that same resident.
And they haven't fixed it.
No.
Okay. Yeah, I will. It's so funny.
I was talking about that too. Then I got the call today. So I was like, I bet I know what he's calling about.
Well, and you know, one of the neighbors.
Yes,
we got that call. Okay. One of the neighbors. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So I thought, well, no, I'm not hearing. She's gone.
Yeah,
so now that's why you're
gay. Okay. Well, yeah, well, and I can see the fence because it's a same place.
Yeah, it's on the inside.
Yeah, so like,
and it does look like
a whole
sign down.
Yeah, there's a big.
Can I ask a me question?
Yeah, of course you can.
So the tree that I got for Arbor Day never blew
into the water from it.
Well, sometimes it takes a couple of years.
Does it really?
Yes. I planted something a couple. I don't know what kind it is, but I planted one 7 years ago, and this is the first year.
Actually, had leaves in there.
Yeah, and flowers.
Okay. All right. Then I'll be patient.
What kind is it? Okay, that's weird. Okay, that was not my experience. Okay, I'll ask.
Now I need the hammer.
Yeah.
No, we'll figure it out. Yeah, that's the way it was. All right, anybody ready? We're going to reconvene. All right. Next on the agenda is Bassett Creek Park. All right. I just want to make sure you're in the room. All right. Do you want to tee us off on this one?
Sure. All right. Happy to. Good evening again, Mr. Mayor, council members. Onto a park that was addressed in the Park System Master Plan. So Bassett Creek Park. You may recall as we went through the master planning process, this was kind of the bubble diagrams. There were several bubble diagrams that morphed as time went on. And this was kind of the final one that talked about all your sport fields and most active kind of things here. This area is naturalized landscape, primitive trails, kind of like what's there now. Picnicking in kind of this yellow area. And then this green area is frisbee golf / landscape enhancements. So that's native vegetated areas, gravel trails, things like that. There's still some paved trails in there, but it's basically the naturalized areas along the south side of the park. So what happened then is this bubble diagram turned into kind of more of a master plan concept. And the concept isn't the final design, but it's kind of sets the stage for where things should be located. So, I'll just flip right away to this. So basically what we've got in our capital plan is most of the things on this side of the park are 2022-23. And then in a few years, we're looking at a new building over here in 26 and then 27 with soccer in the parking lot. And then 28, we're looking at shelter, volleyball, things like that. And then way further down the line is looking at the spikes for the baseball field. So it's kind of trying to chunk the park into different parts. And the years we're not here, we're in other parks. So the idea is that you try to, you know, get around the different parks in the system. So the Prairie Restoration Project was one that was brought up at the last council meeting. And the reason that Prairie was proposed here and discussed during the master planning process is tall grasses and colorful wildflowers in a prairie attract and provide shelter for numerous birds and endangered pollinators. So I know we've talked a lot about pollinators here. Deep roots of the prairie help stabilize soil and soak up stormwater runoff. So you've got, you know, parking lots, you know, stormwater races across that, mowed turf. It slows down a little bit, but it still, you know, goes down into the Bassett Creek. But then if you get into more prairie grasses, then that tends to slow that process down. Prairie self-recharge groundwater, and then they also require less long-term maintenance. So that's kind of why the whole prairie discussion came up. So after the master planning process was completed, we got in touch with Great River Greening, and they said, hey, you know, can we help you with this? You know, can we bring you some money and help get this prairie thing going? So we did work with them, and they were able to secure some grant funds to help us with this, restore this area into prairie. And that's through the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund grant and Outdoor Heritage Fund grant. So $85,000 from Great River Greening, and then $11,000 over 5 years for the city. So that's kind of what that, how that was packaged. So what it would do is currently the area is mowed. It's 10 acres of mowed grass. And then what the, you know, I guess the vision would be is that it would be turned into something like this. So it's prairie grasses. This is the same type of seed mix that they're looking at for Bassett Creek. Just another view of the same type of thing. And then part of the master plan too is that the disc golf course that goes through that area now would there'd be mowed fairways through the prairie. So that's fairly common. You see that in disc golf courses. Disc golfers tend to like having a little bit of interest in the course. So this is down at Bryant Lake Park, Three Rivers Park in Eden Prairie. So you can see how they've got prairie around it and then mowed fairways through the middle. And then this is one down at Springdale County Park. And, you know, they've got the mowed fairways through the prairie. So that was kind of what the vision was for this golf course. I know last time we met, we didn't have any pictures of what this might look like. So I'm bringing that to you tonight. And then at the last meeting, you know, the commission talked about this and made a motion to recommend moving forward with the prairie and this golf or the prairie project. So that's a quick overview of, you know, if there's any questions on any of the projects in Bassett Creek or want more discussion on the prairie and this golf projects.
Anyone?
Nancy, go ahead.
Really appreciate the pictures, because when I saw the first field, it's like I'd be looking for my disc forever. I'm terrible at it, but this is really helpful to have the fairways, much like a golf course. So thank you for that. Just curious too, somewhat related, how's the bridge coming? Or were you going to address that later?
No, the bridge, our consultants working with the watershed district. There's some stormwater models, and I know the watershed district's changing some of those models. So they were, from what I understand, they got permission to go ahead with the old model.
Okay.
So they're working on that. And the intent is to get a permit application in here this month and then get that reviewed, because, you know, it's in the floodplain, so they want to make sure that if there's a flood event, that the water is not going to take the bridge away.
Sure.
Or cause any other issues.
Great, thank you.
That's still going to be a winter thing when it gets put in?
Hopefully late fall, winter.
Okay. John?
Last night at the EQC, we did speak about the prairie restoration project briefly, and there was unanimous support for it. So they thought it was a good thing. They've been doing the oak forest. The mm-hmm. renovation, you know, has been an ongoing project for us, and the disc golfers are excited to, you know, they like the idea of it, adding it to it, a little more nuance to the disc golf, and just overall, I think the idea of what you mapped out in terms of water storage or sponge, as you want to call it, mm-hmm. is a real benefit to the park itself. So, thank you.
All right, Forrest.
I would just like to point out one is that at that vote was unanimous as well that we passed at the so that's where we all voted for the prairie as well. And on a more personal note, I'm a disc golfer. I'm also a lifelong Bassett Creek is my home course. So I grew up golfing there at every Sunday from middle school through high school through the day. And honestly, this really excites me as both a disc golfer and then also as a natural resource professional. Prairie is something that is one great for the environment and great for people as well. It creates a nice visual element, a nice landscape with flowers, attracts more interesting birds, makes a more interesting course, as John mentioned, the golfers and Peter mentioned as well. I have a number of other courses I like that aren't my home courses, but things like Riverside, Fridley, Hanson, and Brighton, these are courses that are very fun, very just like exciting, partially because of the prairie hazards as well. If you think of it as like, can you imagine golfing without sand traps or rock, right? It just wouldn't be the same. So currently it's just all fairway. It's very common for you to, because of that, visually when you're throwing, it's a little bit more difficult to say exactly where you want it to go. And, you know, you can get a little easy and just kind of throw it because there's everything in the fairway. You don't have to worry about it. So it does excite me that the course is being redesigned, that we will have those challenges. And I mean, when you think about a lot of the destination parks in the Twin Cities besides golf courses, they have prairie as well. I mean, some of the most busy parks in the Twin Cities, Mill Ruins, Galloway by St. Anthony, huge restored prairie there. Eloise Butler Gardens, huge restored prairie there. St. Paul, Bruce Mento, Nature Sanctuary, one of the new Hopkins County parks in St. Paul, huge prairie there as well. And these are things that visitors, when the National Park Service manages the Mississippi River Gorge area, they're excited to get out there, see the wildlife, see it as a destination. And also volunteer element as well for some of these parks is very exciting as a community. So I am just want to let you know personally, super love it, add a lifetime faculty involved.
I think what our issue early on was just that when the chemicals were sprayed, that there wasn't signage, and we noticed people where their kids and dogs were running around in the area. That was a huge concern. I think that was the only roadblock.
Oh, no, not for me. Not for me.
Not the only roadblock, but a roadblock. It was one of the roadblocks.
The reason we're talking about this is because there were conversations about having a medal put in that space. And years ago, it's like, yeah, no, not that's that. That's too versatile of a space. We've got too many uses in that space. And I thought that was dismissed. The reason we're here is because I saw a machine going back forth spraying in this area. And I looked, that's not a city vehicle. So I wandered out there. I did manage to see, there was a sign. It was about, I don't know, 3/4 of this with a QR code? Mm-hmm. QR code. And it was like, I don't know, 15 yards off of the path that I saw there. And I walked around the park and then I said, well, that looks like those exercise things that they had on the other side of the pond. But, okay, let's check it out. And it was indeed the conversation about the prairie. And I'm like, what? A prairie project? And it was the next day when they were coming out to kill the grass. I stopped them. I said, what you doing? You know, I was kind of curious. And while we're killing the grass, we have a metal project going on. I said, okay, you're done. She says, well, we have a contract. I'll be finishing that. I said, well, you need to call your boss. I'm going to call some people at the city. So as it stands right now, We just got weeds kind of filling in where the grass is dead. But I stopped the project. I personally stopped the project and made some phone calls. Found out that you guys were completely informed and we were not. So number one, that got under my skin. Number two, we want to do things here in a way that we have input, that we have that back and forth. And we did that with Becker Park. Becker Park was, that's the goal. We want to do that back and forth stuff. And I think the part that kind of got to me was, it was a couple of weeks before in the council meeting, we had to approve the parking lots. And I wanted to make some comments about the parking lots because I wanted to put some input in there. And again, it's like John says to me, well, you know, all the research has been done, it's been online, blah, 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 blah. And we're just asking you to approve the amount. So there was no conversation going on. So what I have here is a series of things happening in this park where we can get the information. And we didn't have that back and forth input. I can't stand the idea of having a prairie in that space. You're gonna have to hold on a minute.
Yep.
It's not that I hate prairies. It's just in that location, it drives me crazy. We have sledding that goes on in that prairie area. It's hard to have a sledding field in the middle of a prairie. That's even at the lower level, you're still gonna have that stuff sticking up. We have cross-country ski meets that go back there. We have snowshoeing. We have just things my kids and I used to do back there. By the way, if you go back to that sheet, you can see my house. My backyard is that park. We've done soccer practices back there. We've done after-school events. I mean, we've had 281 schools come, kneel, and do after-school events in that space. It is a space that's kind of free. It's a space that's not been designated for a specific purpose. If I were to do something with that space, what I would do is make it more level, make it so that there aren't any holes in there so that it can function more as a free space. Putting a prairie in that large of a space is, I think it just takes away the different uses. And if you would have asked me if you would have asked me, do you want to go ahead and just make that space prairie with some cutouts for disc golf, and that's pretty much all you can do there, I'd think, well, you know, that'd be a cool disc golf deal. That much of it? No, absolutely not. I mean, we can do some of the areas on what would be the other side of Brunswick, the west side of Brunswick. There's different places you can go ahead and do that. You can still put prairie in, but that flat area between the creek and to the south of that creek, well, even the hill for that matter, it's being used for the bike races. I think we're missing it. Becker Park is designed to have a destination deal. I don't know that just encompassing that whole area for disc golf is really creating that much of a destination. I think you lose some of the versatility. So I think we need to take a step back. And just a minute. I think we need to take a step back and have a relook, at least with this organized, with this group up here, have some feedback back and forth. I'm looking at the plan now, and you know, you can argue that I should have been more in tune with it. And in hindsight, you're absolutely right. We got multiple department heads that have full-time jobs. I have three jobs at least. That needs to come here. We need to have these conversations here. If it's that important, if it's that big of a deal. So I want to just regroup. I think there's a lot of things that in that particular park that I'd like to have some conversations about some things different. I know some of the areas that I'm looking at on the other side of the pond from where I live, so the north side of the pond, I'm not sure I would like the building where it is, or maybe there's an idea for a secondary building. I think there's an awful lot going on in that park that could really bring people into the park and be that regional attraction. Now, when you talk about environmental and having all those different aspects of the park, there's still opportunity in there. There's still spaces that aren't primary. And some people argue that the dog park is not really an environmental space, but the southern part of the forest there is, and that's good enough. You know, it's like, okay, so we're picking and choosing where we want to have the environmental emphasis put in place. Can we have that conversation? I'd really like to have that conversation. Where were you, Jesse?
Yeah, so I guess I just wanted to address some of the things that you mentioned. You know, as a commission, this is something that we've been discussing since probably last year, when John brought to our attention that the city received this grant for the prairie restoration. I remember that it's been in several of the minutes that have been mm-hmm. published, and I think those are documents that need to be reviewed, and these are things that our council liaison should be bringing to your attention as well. I guess on sort of a personal note, you know, I grew up in Crystal, and I grew up around 47th and Brunswick, and when I was growing up, there used to be a very large open field north of where I live. And there was just nothing there. There were some dirt piles. And I remember playing there with my friends and launching rockets and flying kites and that. And we had fun. And I thought, well, you know, one day if I have a child, maybe I'll want to bring my child there. And it was sometime in the 2000s, I think, that that land was developed. And now there are townhomes there. And one of the neat little things that's in the northwest corner is that there is a little pond and there's prairie grass that's around that. And now that I have a daughter, I'm not able to bring her to that open space to do the kinds of things that I did as a kid, but she likes to watch the ducks and listen to the birds that are there. We spend, you know, half an hour at a time sitting there and watching that. And she enjoys that. And I think these are the kinds of opportunities that we can bring to the people that currently live in Crystal and the people that will live in Crystal, is that we have opportunities for open spaces already. Let's bring opportunities for prairie grasses. There's this space on the eastern side of Bassett Creek where the soccer fields are going to be installed based on the master plan. And that's lots of green open space that can be used for the kinds of activities that you're mentioning. But, you know, to bring another facet to Bassett Creek Park, to bring in prairies like this that are going to diversify the ecosystem, bring in new little critters and bring new opportunities for the people that visit there. I agree with Forrest that this is a great opportunity for that park, not just for disc golfers, because quite honestly, I don't really disc golf. It doesn't interest me that much, but I see it as an opportunity to introduce my child to different types of green spaces and to teach her to appreciate what was here before we were here. And I think that's a big part of what this prairie restoration is meant to do.
A couple interesting comments. We do have an awful lot of wildlife in there currently. We have a lot, and I'm not saying no prairie, but to take that whole space up is what I'm arguing, obviously. Oh, there was another point. Lost it. Sorry. Go ahead, John.
I just wanted to say, I kind of went through a similar thing
is what you're going through right now with Welcome Park. We had a tennis court there, and the tennis court is not there anymore. It was decided it was not part of the master park plan. It was they're going to move tennis to Becker. And, you know, I mean, I still have an axe to grind about it. I do talk to John every now and then, but you know, it's, you know, the improvements to the Welcome Park. I mean, we can all say that it's for the better. You know, it's something that's been, you know, I think there's more usage now of Welcome Park than there was when there was a tennis court there. So, I mean, sure. Now, hopefully with the new basketball court, I can kind of sneak on that and swat a few balls at people. But, you know, sometimes this whole change thing, especially when it's like close to you and it's personal and it's something that you use or have, like Jesse was talking about great memories. Sometimes it's hard to move forward on these things. But, you know, I have assurances that, you know, that there's going to be a lot of benefits that come out of this. And so maybe that's just a matter of, like, you know, change sometimes is difficult. It's still difficult for me. I still complain about
it. Yeah. You know, I could say the same thing on some of the other things that have happened there as well. You know, but you can't do a cross country meet. You can't do some of these larger things in a soccer field. You know, it just takes the versatility kind of. So go ahead.
Oh, just real quick, the woodland restoration. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit about what that would look like? That right above.
Yeah, the woodland restoration is what the EQC is working on right now.
Yeah.
Pulling out the mustard and the, you know, clearing
buckthorn and garlic mustard, and so every Thursday night.
I've been walking up in there, and I've noticed how much cleaner it is. It's really nice to walk up there. Just wondered if there's any more plantings, or is it mainly just clearing and
Nancy? We have gloves. You're welcome.
I know.
And tools.
You know? Yes.
My neighbors behind.
Yeah.
This is an ongoing project.
Right, but it's looking really nice. I just wondered what if there were any other additions or besides the pulling. You know.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really trying to, there's kind of a couple things going on. That's the oak trees that are in that particular area were there before houses.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why that is kind of an important place to start. So it's really clearing out the understory of those things that you don't want there. Mm-hmm. And then that allows some additional oak trees to grow up.
Nice.
Some other things have been talked about, but not in any plan yet, is to add some fruit trees. You know, for wildlife. That's one of the things you're seeing now in some woodland areas, not necessarily in the oak trees, but maybe where the old Brunswick Avenue went through, there might be some opportunities to do things.
Okay. And one last question, the hill where I see a lot of people sledding, is there a way we could have a little fairway for them or a path, you know, an area for sledders in the winter?
Yeah, I mean, we don't promote that as a sliding hill. We have Valley Place. Mm-hmm. Really close. But yeah, I mean, there will be fairways through there, you know, so in the winter.
So there would be some.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't looked at it.
Not a lot, but I've seen a lot of kids running up and down the hill and sliding down it. And I don't know, Jim, if you've seen it, you must
live there. Oh, I see it every winter.
But it's popular when we walk past that area in the winter.
Yeah.
Just curious. Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to restoration, you want to restore that space. It would be a swamp then. I mean, that's what it was. You know, prairie came after swamp, but that's what it was. Just a side note. Therese.
Bassett Creek is a huge park.
There's
room for all kinds of things. And the idea of the prairie restoration, I think, is great. If you're putting the paths in for the fairways, that can also lead to some nice cross-country skiing or snowshoeing. We go through the paths. I'm not a golfer, but I do cross country and I do snowshoe. So through a prairie on the path, it'd be great. It's a big park. If you want to play soccer, there's a place to play soccer. If you want to play kickball, there's a place to do that. And with the decrease in habitat for the pollinators, and you have a grant. It's kind of a no-brainer for me.
You have a grant. I don't know who's John. Go ahead.
Bottom line, people move here to the city because of the parks. I think that you know, I think you're gonna
you're going to find that there's a lot of support for the prairie restoration. You're going to find there's a lot of support for all the aspects that we're bringing to our park and programs, because we've planned for it. We for many, many years, our parks were just pretty much just the area where our rainwater collected after a heavy rainstorm. And now we're actually getting to the point where we're getting some great value out of it. And it's something that kind of drives this city and adds, you know, kind of a wonderful aspect to why you want to live here. I don't think I have much more than that. I just am in support of the Prairie Restoration Project, as well as the Oak Forest Restoration. I mean, I think anything that we do to Bassett Creek is a plus. So. And like I said, you know, change is hard. I struggle with it myself daily, but I think anything that we do to our parks to just create a welcoming environment is a plus.
So I just want to say this, not in my backyard.
Yeah, well, that's fair. That's completely fair.
Okay. That was a joke, by the way. For those of you who didn't laugh.
NIMBY.
What I do want to do, though, is to have an opportunity for us to have a conversation about that plan and have it more of like a work plan, like what we've done in the past. I think that's important. Lynn, go ahead.
Like Debbie had mentioned, we as a commission have always been under the impression that you know what we're doing, that you're reading the minutes, that you see our hat, etc. Because as far as we knew, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know that the onus is necessarily on the commission and on John that you didn't know about the information, because we discussed it for several months. So the information was out there.
No, that point is not lost on me. I understand that. And I think everybody in the room understands that. Bottom line is, things have been done a lot different than they were done in the past.
So, and with that, this part of the master plan was not quick. That was all part of the planning. People in the area were in on all of those discussions when we had it in as far as referring. And just the last thing is, yeah, change this car and it's in your backyard. So, I mean, then I will say this because I was in on the discussions when we did turn. And those discussions were, they were strong and they were really impactful, because we took away what people perceived as their backyard and what they should be looking at as their backyard and how they should be using that backyard that they perceived as theirs, but it was not. And there is that idea of change. And the whole idea of change is the pool is very hard on me. But I gotta go with what everybody says. The same with the better part. But I think these are the things we have to look at, because this was something that was done accurately. It wasn't just John and Brad deciding, well, we need to put a prairie here, you know, let's go get a grant. That wasn't what happened. So these are all things that were written down and that were followed. And I guess that was the biggest thing, was the fact that you didn't have the information. So I think this is
something. All right. All right. I think you've got that point made. Thank you. Yeah.
Well,
Forrest.
I have opened a great point here. As you go back and consider this on your own, the word destination was brought up multiple times, and when we're thinking about planning and, you know, placemaking specifically surrounding places people want to go, and driving at a place that is made specifically as a destination, you design those places for a specific purpose and you do that purpose well, right? So right now, the Bass Creek disc golf course is a nice disc golf course, but it's not planned in a way that is necessarily one of the best in the Twin Cities that people go to. You can go to a number of other disc golf courses that we can talk, like, for example, Riverside. You go there any day after 4 o'clock, it is packed. You're waiting to get on the tee box. I mean, they have benches there because you have to wait. And it's not just leaf next that it's sold to see. And so just consider that when we go back that, you know, right now it's kind of doing a lot of different things. And I understand that some people value that. But if we want to make a destination, if we want to make it a place that is meaningful for not just the community, but the region, we have to do it in a way that the activity is highlighted in the best way possible, right? Instead of trying to muddle it a little bit with other activities.
Or, you know, I agree with that it hasn't been the best, and they always add these extra holes to make it complete and that sort of thing. And we haven't done a good job of it. And I agree. I think there's ways to do it, but I think there's enough space in that to really take some time and design it, you know, in a way that's more functional, and that has more of that demand, because you're right. My whole perception of this golf from what I've experienced from city staff is not a fan. And that's what it looks like, not a fan. So if we're going to have it, yes, we're going to have it. We should do it the best we can. And that's why this was that's why it struck me so strange that we would designate that much of that area of the park for these different fairways. It's like, whoa, okay, not what I perceived. I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
Oh, I just had a comment. Is there out of bounds in this call?
If you're playing in a tournament, yes. Okay. But if you're playing recreationally, if it goes out of bounds,
then yeah, I know one of the holes I can see from my backyard, it goes everywhere. I mean, your point as to where it goes, it goes in a tree, it goes into the what's currently green, and it goes into what's currently brown, you know, and it's just this huge, huge variety of where it goes. I don't know quite what that looks like, how much space opens up closer to a hole. If it's as wide as, it's obviously not as wide as a golf course, but looks like it starts narrow and kind of gets wider, but I don't know. Go ahead, Brendan.
I guess I have my only real comments, you know, I guess it's kind of, what is the point of a master plan if we see like something that comes up that, you know, that somebody doesn't like, or, you know, comes up, and then what's the point of it, right? If we're objecting to it, if prior, like it's something that's already been established and stuff's been, you know, I would say that's like, just saying that I feel like that feels very much like after the fact. Can I finish?
Yes.
Thank you. And it's not done. I think it's very important that it was a unanimous decision. I'm a very communal person, right? So I very much pay attention to when there is a, like a rift, you know, and kind of where everybody is at. And so I don't want the park commission to feel like that's like dawned on that's missed, right? You guys do a lot of hard work, and I think probably one of the most active commissions and most involved commissions, and so I think that's great. But it's great. I mean, it's greatly appreciated, I guess, like from my perspective. It's kind of like when I look at just anything else, we have these master plans, and, you know, things are set in motion, and it's like, all right, this is, you guys are doing a lot of the hard work, and this is a huge community thing. I wish, you know, I think for most part, our commissions are very involved. And so I guess it's kind of like, I look at the park and the master plan. I'm like, that looks amazing. It looks great. You guys are doing the work, and there was a lot of work and thought and stuff, but it's not something that just kind of popped up overnight. And so I think it's just kind of like my feel from it, you know, that's where I'm at.
So on the master plan thing, you know, some of the master plan, the out years, so to speak, not the initial master plan, all that stuff wasn't necessarily put in place, location, you know, type of things. There were just some basic characteristics. And the comments when we created the master plan was, well, we'll talk about that as we come upon that. And it's not like long-term planning. When are we going to have to replace roads? When are we going to have to do this maintenance? It's a little bit different in, okay, it's coming up. We have the money. We want to do this. Let's take a look closer at what specifically we want to do there. And that's the piece that I feel is missing. Thank you for your point. I hope that you don't think I'm angry with you guys and what you've done. That is not my intent whatsoever. I just want to make sure that's clear. Was it Jesse? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add real quick to Brendan's comment. You know, we really appreciate that recognition. And every year that I've been on the commission, one of the topics that always comes up is how can we get improved communication between the commission and the council. Every single year, it's always a topic that comes up at least a couple months out of the year, is that, you know, we don't want what we do to be, you know, to not influence or be heard in any way. We want there to be crosstalk because we recognize that all of you are responsible for many different things about the city. You can't be an expert in every single aspect of what's going on. And so I think the fact that we have these commissions, that we have experts that you delegate tasks to, demonstrates your trust in us. And we want to reciprocate that trust by informing you of what's going on. What are we talking about? And what are our thoughts on it? Because that's the way that we as a community get things done, right? Is by having these conversations. And so I guess I just want to say too, that I really appreciate over the last couple of years that there have been more of these joint work sessions, because this is the opportunity, right? To have these conversations in a formal environment and to talk about these issues together that affect not just us, but every single person that lives and commutes to Crystal.
Thank you, Jesse. Go ahead, Tony.
This is more of a question for John. With the council, do you know the process of restoring the prairie and the overlay of this golf course? Do you decide what is up from there? So I think that's one of this in this discussion that
no.
It's not going to be golf prairie, and we're also looking at how do we reshape that this golf course? I think there's a this golf course is the walk for multiple poles, so there's some trails that have to go through all that prairie. I think how that prairie is going to look at the end of this process is still something we're working on as commissioners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't have that disc golf course design quite yet. So
I understand that. I think that's just part of the process, Tony, that I think we need to go through, kind of see what a little bit more detail what's being proposed. That's what I need.
I'd say one more thing. And the only thing I think I could, what's missing, and I don't know where it happened, right? But I think back to, was it Iron Horse Park? The one by the railroad tracks, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So when we were doing Iron Horse Park, I remember before like anything happened, we got these drawings, right?
Yeah.
And you guys, this is what you approved, like the work that you approved, and we looked at it. And I mean, I don't know if for this that ever happened. And as I'm thinking about it, and that's not on necessarily on the commission, I don't know where that happened, but I would say, I think that's probably where the mayor's probably biggest frustration is. Not that he doesn't support any of this, sure. But I think the rest of the council can, you know, recall like some like the other projects. And even, you know, I mean, I came in on the back end of Becker Park. It was like, you know, already kind of in motion, right? But even still, as we were going through the phases, there was, oh, here are these drawings. This is, you know, before anything was like ever, everything, before anything had been executed. If that, does that make any sense? Just as I'm kind of hearing, I think that's what you're probably one of your biggest frustrations.
Biggest frustration, absolutely.
Because did anybody else get, like, I don't think we didn't get, you know what I'm talking about, John? We didn't get any of those, like that presentation on, okay, hey, this is the Parks and Rec Commission, you know, this is what came up. It was an unanimous decision. This is what, you know, this is kind of where, you know, we're at, what we're going with it, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, what's your input, that type of thing. And again, what I'm saying, Lynn, is there is oftentimes, right, like I said, with everything else, I think this is the only thing that I have seen since I've been on the council, that when, like I said, and I just thought of Iron Horse Park as a prime example. Like, you guys did the work, it came, right, and you know, we looked at it, you know, and talked about it, and kind of, I don't even think we necessarily even made any changes to it, right? I don't necessarily fully recall all that. I've slept a couple times since then, but it was like, hey, here is this work, and it's this great, you know, piece of work, and you got, you know, and all right, here, you know, here we go. Versus what I perceived the mayor's also coming in, hey, you know, there is this great piece of work, and we can see all that, right? Not discounting all that. It was, we didn't even, not that we didn't know about it, but there wasn't even a discussion here about it. Yeah.
You know, and I think in Becker Park, we did have some suggestions, and there were some actual changes that came from this body. So a little bit different than Iron Horse, but yeah, I think you've nailed it. John?
With Iron Horse, we had three lots that we sold as well for homes. And so there were some significant changes to the park itself, and more for an informational aspect to us as a council in terms of for the community itself to make sure that they were aware of what was going on and the improvements that were going to happen to the park itself to make it better. So that's part of it. And I think also the dollar amount, we only have $11,000, which is what we're putting into this prairie restoration. So it kind of falls underneath our scope. So it ends up being more or less kind of a line item blurb, which is in the master park plan, as opposed to something where an actual full-scale presentation would be given to us as a council. So that's kind of like you know, the nuts and bolts of, you know, the differences between the two. So
I think it's you're done. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go right ahead. You can jump in if you think, you know, you can have some to add. That's fine. Yeah. I think I got it all.
You know, I think as we move forward and we have these parks that are coming in piecemeal, we need to kind of have those represented and see kind of where we're heading, where we're going a little bit more, rather than, okay, this actually hit the threshold. We have to go to the council for this thing. Okay, here we go. You know, that sort of thing. Aaron.
So with all due respect, I think the impression of this commission is that all of that was happening. That is our understanding of what the liaison should be. And so I think your surprised us. So it feels like there's perhaps an opportunity for the staff to get the packet because of the materials perspective. But it also feels like there's an opportunity to clarify roles and responsibilities of what we need some goal should do, because we clearly had a different expectation than what was presented. But I think the fact that this was that came as such a surprise to the council, I think it was equally surprising to us that you were not. And so it feels like there's perhaps an opportunity to be done, or at least.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Aaron. All right. I don't think there's any action we need to do as a group here. I think it's just a matter of regrouping and moving forward.
So what would you like from us for continue working on this golf course design?
What I'd like to do is have an open conversation and a work session for this group to kind of talk about what's being proposed, have some input in it as well. We do care about it too. I think there's some opportunities that I don't think we've ever talked about that I have that I'd really like to have on the table for Bassett Creek. And I think there's a ton of opportunity there.
For all aspects of the park or just for the prairie restoration?
I would say all aspects to start with, you know, and we can start focusing, then we can come back and focus on what's in the near term. Are we really going to go ahead and do this, or are we going to rethink some of that?
So prairie restoration, technically kind of like the Oak Forest restoration, is happening now. So are you saying, you know, continue that, or, I mean, just.
No, I mean, let's have a conversation. I mean,
because there. The actual prairie restoration there's a timeline for it to be planted, which is here in the fall. So they're basically getting the terrain ready for that process to happen. So how soon do we as a council, you know, take up this? I mean, because
we could talk about the whole park as a whole, but there's this one aspect of it that has to be decided upon relatively quickly.
I don't know. I don't know the process. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's for planting prairie, there's certainly a timeline for that. And so we plant in spring or the fall.
And how far, far behind are we already, or aren't we?
Well, the plan, I think, was to plan early in the year, but we decided to plant in fall.
And that's
before the heat, after the heat season goes and before it gets too late to plant grassy.
I'd like to have a conversation. I really would, before we move forward on the prairie.
Okay, so we have so within the next month, we're going to.
We'll have to, you guys have a lot of meetings. I've got you booked a lot coming up.
Can we put it on the August 4th work session to discuss?
That's going to be budget, and I think you're going to need most of the time, but we could certainly put it on there.
How about next week on the 19th? We have a work session.
You have three days of meetings next week. I don't think that's fair to do to you.
All right.
I get this is urgent, but I also need to keep you alive.
Yep.
We'll figure it out.
Okay.
All right, John?
Absolutely.
Can I say thanks to all you guys for all the work you've been doing on this?
Yes, thank you.
It's really appreciated.
Mm-hmm. And it's buckthorn, not weed pulling. So.
No, it's kind of a weed, though.
All right,
yellow sign of chief for you here, right?
That is the last item on the agenda. We are adjourned. Thank you all.